Legend of Yufei, Chapter 73.
Let's set the scene. We're in Linen City. It's been years since Yufei died, and the guy widely seen as the traitor, Qin Wei, he died rich and powerful. No justice there.
Exactly. And the system just feels corrupt. Loyalists are asking this really dangerous question. Why hasn't heaven done anything? Why the silence?
And this huge moral outrage, it kind of gets focused through one person, right?
Yeah.
Our main guy.
That's Hu Dai. His courtesy name is Mengdi. And what's important is he's a Zhukai, sort of an entry-level scholar. He's supposed to be all about Confucian morals and order.
But he's looking around and seeing none of it.
Precisely. Sources say he's just consumed by this indignation. He keeps writing this phrase over and over, and it's incredibly risky. Heaven and earth are biased. Ghosts and gods are unjust.
Wow. Okay, that's basically accusing the entire universe of being rigged. The government, the gods, the whole system.
Yeah, and this this simmering anger, it's about to boil over big time.
So what's the trigger? What finally pushes him over the edge?
Well, it starts with hope, ironically. This figure, Black Man Long, shows up with troops. He's marching on Linen, demanding the officials responsible for Yufei's death be handed over.
Ah, okay. So it feels like maybe justice is coming from the outside, like a military intervention.
Exactly. Hu Dai is apparently ecstatic. The text says he calls it fast-hearted business. He thinks, okay, finally, someone's going to force the issue.
And how does that play out initially?
Well, the first reports sound great for Hu Dai. Black Man Long kills an official named Wang Wu, makes camp nearby. The court actually panics and sends out Zhang Jun, another official Hu Dai totally despises, thinks he's a traitor too.
So Hu Dai's probably thinking, good, maybe he'll get what's coming to him too.
Oh, absolutely. He openly wishes Zhang Jun would die. And then for a moment, it looks like Hu Dai's side is winning. The court actually promises to hand over the guilty party within 10 days.
So Hu Dai must be thinking, it's happening.
Totally. He's overjoyed. The text says he grabs some wine, goes to his study to drink alone, just waiting for the final confirmation. He gets completely drunk. The word used is han, like thoroughly intoxicated and vulnerable.
Oh, I have a bad feeling about this.
Yeah. Right when he's in this hopeful, drunken state, his family comes back with the news, and it's devastating.
Don't tell me.
Black Man Long didn't win. He was defeated by Zhang Jun.
Oh, and Zhang Jun.
Zhang Jun is celebrated. The court heaps honors on him, promotes him. High office.
Ugh, that's just rubbing salt in the wound.
It's the ultimate validation of the injustice. The injure fails. The traitor gets rewarded again.
And that's it for Hu Dai. That's the breaking point. The text says his heart feels like it's on fire. He slams the table in rage. Tandanu. I can almost picture it. Pure fury.
And in that moment, he grabs yellow paper, significant color, right? Imperial divine associations. And he writes this incredibly defiant poem.
And does he, like, post it somewhere?
No, he burns it immediately, right there, under the lamp. It's like sending a direct, furious message straight to the spirit world.
Okay, so what does this celestial complaint actually say?
The key lines basically accuse everyone. Heaven's court is silent without retribution. The underworld is surely biased. He's saying both realms are failing.
But he goes further, doesn't he? Yeah. There's that threat.
Oh, yeah. This is the really dangerous part. He says, look, if I were the king of Hellyama, I wouldn't stand for this. I'd personally flay that traitor's skin for, wait for it, 10,000 kalpas.
10,000 kalpas. Okay, we need to pause there. That's not just a long time, is it? In, like, Buddhist terms, that's immense.
It's almost unimaginable. We're talking cosmic geological ages. It's not just life imprisonment. It's the maximum possible sentence stretched across near eternity.
So he's not just complaining. He's saying, the current management is incompetent. I could do this job better, and here's how I'd handle it. With extreme prejudice.
Pretty much. He's applying for the job of chief cosmic punisher, based on his own sense of justice. He's challenging the king of hell directly.
And you generally don't do that without getting a response, I imagine.
You imagine correctly. The response is immediate. The smoke from the burning poem has barely cleared.
Let me guess. Knock, knock.
Basically, two ghost officials, described as wearing black robes, Zhaoyi Gali, like underworld bureaucrats, they just appear. And they say, the king wants to see you. Come with us.
Just like that. And Hu Shu Di.
He's stunned, obviously, but he goes. Now, the story makes a point here. His spirit goes, but back in his study, his servant finds his body slumped in the chair.
Still alive.
Barely. The text says his heart area is still slightly warm, Shangxi Wei Wen. It tells the reader, okay, this is a journey of the soul, a vision perhaps, but it's real in its implications.
Right. So where do they take him? Is it just fire and brimstone straight away?
Not exactly. They travel apparently over 10 miles through this really bleak landscape. desolate, rainy, autumn-feeling Huangjiao Yeti Yan Yu Fei Fei. It definitely sets a mood. He's not in Kansas anymore.
And the destination?
They arrive at this imposing place, a walled complex or a city called the Spirit Radiance Residence, Lingyao Zifu. What's striking is it sounds organized, structured, like a government building almost.
Okay, so it's bureaucratic hell, maybe?
Well, the security detail is definitely old school hell. Standing guard are the ox head and horse face figures, you know, the classic underworld enforcers.
Oh, yeah, those guys with the forks and hammers.
Carrying steel forks and iron hammers, exactly. So you have this bizarre mix, terrifying mythological guards outside a seemingly administrative center.
It's like the DMV meets ancient mythology.
Kind of, yeah. The terror is real, but it serves the order inside. Hu Di is understandably terrified. He's brought into the main hall.
And who's waiting for him?
The big boss. Yama, the king of hell. And he's not depicted as some slavering demon. He's sitting there in formal imperial robes, Gunyi Mianlu, like a human emperor would wear. Very official.
So the presentation is all about legitimate authority.
Absolutely. And he's flanked by attendants, six officials in green robes, holding ledgers, Wenbu. These are clerks, record keepers. The whole scene screams, this is not chaos. This is law, order, administration. Just, you know, cosmic administration.
Okay, so the trial begins. What's the charge?
Yama doesn't mince words. He basically roars at Hu Di. How dare you, a scholar, someone who should know better, resent heaven and hate earth and slander ghosts and gods? And he quotes the poem back to him.
So the message definitely got through, loud and clear.
Oh, yeah. Delivery confirmed. Now, Hu Di, he's scared, but he doesn't completely fold. He admits he wrote it while drunk, but he stands by the reason for his anger.
He justifies it. He does. He brings up Yufei's loyal service and suffering, contrasts it with the traitor Qin Hui living high on the hog. He argues his anger isn't personal. It's righteous indignation based on observable facts.
That's bold. How does Yama react to that?
This is where it gets interesting. Instead of just sentencing him, Yama sets a test. He demands Hu Di write a formal statement, a confession. I could gong swan.
Make his case in writing.
Exactly. And the stakes are high. If the argument is logically sound, if it proves his intentions were righteous, Yama says he'll send him back to the living world. If the writing is flawed, emotional, unjustifiable,
then
it's off to the knife mountain hell for Hu Di.
Wow. So his life depends on his ability to write a persuasive essay defending his slander of the gods.
Pretty much. It's a trial by rhetoric judged by the king of hell. It brilliantly shifts the political argument onto this cosmic ethical stage. He has to use his scholarly skills to save his own skin.
So how does he do? Does he choke?
Not at all. The text says he writes quickly, fluently. He basically doubles down. He argues his motives were pure, to raise the straight and punish the wrong. He insists his anger comes from a place of ultimate justice, a zhizheng jishen.
He's owning it?
Completely. He explicitly states the core problem again. He mourns the loyal official's death and hates the thief's complete survival. And then he throws Yama's own question back at him, essentially. Given this evidence, what does Heaven's Way know? Where are the ghosts and gods?
He's saying my outburst is proof that you're not doing your job.
Mm.
It's like his slander is actually evidence that the system should be just, and therefore his demand for justice is legitimate.
That's a great way to put it. He's framing his transgression as a defense of the cosmic order's principles, even as he criticizes its practice.
Okay, that's a pretty strong argument. Does Yama buy it?
Yama is.
Yeah.
Well, he calls Hu Di obstinate zhizheng, stubborn, but he admits the essay is powerful. However, he zooms in on one specific line, the most direct challenge.
Let me guess. If I were to be king in hell.
Bingo. Yama basically asks, okay, Mr. Smarty Pants scholar, if you were king of hell, what happens to me? Where does that leave the current administration?
Ah, the succession question.
Hmm?
Always tricky. It's less about theology now and more about cosmic politics.
Exactly. But Hu Di is ready for this. He shifts gears brilliantly from ethics to history and precedent. He starts naming names.
Oh, like who?
He cites famous, respected figures from Chinese history, Han Qinhu, Kulai Gong, Minister Jiang, who, according to legend or popular belief, also spoke about becoming judges or even the king of hell after their death because they were so righteous.
So he's saying, hey, it's not just me being arrogant. This is a thing. Righteous dudes sometimes get earmarked for this job.
Precisely. He argues that this proves the position of king of hell isn't just inherited or appointed randomly. It's reserved for righteous gentlemen, Shijian Zengren Junzi. Mortals whose virtue is so outstanding, they qualify for underworld management.
That reframes his boast entirely. It's not a threat, it's aspiration. Proof of his own perceived righteousness, aligned with tradition.
Exactly. He's saying, my statement aligns me with these great historical figures known for their integrity. It legitimizes his claim while subtly critiquing Yama's current performance against that standard.
And does he address the awkward, what about the current king part?
He does. He smooths it over by explaining the system, or at least his understanding of it. If a new, more righteous king takes over the underworld post, the previous king doesn't just get kicked out.
No. What happens?
He gets reborn in the human world as a great noble, a Wangong Daren. So it's presented as this virtuous cycle. Prove your exceptional morality on Earth. Maybe you get a turn running hell. When your term is up, or someone even more righteous comes along, you get rewarded with a high status rebirth.
Okay, that's quite a system he's describing. It makes the whole thing sound less like a coup and more like cosmic term limits based on merit.
Right. And Yama, faced with this well-argued case backed by historical precedent and a clear succession plan, he has to concede. The text says Yama admits Hudi's words contain profound reasoning swanly.
So Hudi wins. He gets to go home.
Almost. Yama accepts the argument, but he can't just let this mad scholar, as he calls him, walk away thinking he can just mouth off to the cosmos and treat the underworld like it's nothing like wind and moon shadow.
He needs to learn some respect or see the proof.
See the proof. Yama decides Hudi needs a lesson, an education. Since Hudi doubts the system's justice, Yama rules that he must be shown the system in action.
Wow.
He orders one of the green-robed officials, the clerks, to take Hudi on a tour, a complete tour, beyond Guanzong Yu Baoyin. Show him all the different hells, show him the punishments, the retributions being carried out. Starting right at the main event location, the plundering prison, Pu Luiziu. What does it actually look like when Hudi gets there? Because this isn't quite like, say, Dante's vision, is it?
No, it's very distinctly Chinese cosmology. The description paints this picture of just immense cold dread. Imagine these towering high walls made of white stone, a huge iron gate. Very imposing. And Hudi can only get in because his guide, this clerk in a green robe, has an official pass from the King of Hell himself. They even have to show it to the gatekeeper, who's described as a yaksha demon.
Right, so security is tight, even in hell.
Very. And once inside, the scale is just staggering. The source says it's over 50 miles wide. That's what, maybe 15 miles across? And the atmosphere. It's described as having grim daylight, and the air is just constantly, oppressively cold. It's built for suffering, basically.
And it's not just one big torture pit, is it? You mentioned structure. It sounds almost organized, specialized, highly organized. That's key. This isn't random chaos. It's a system. The prison is divided into four specific sectors, each tied to a cardinal direction. So in the east, you've got the Wind and Thunder prison. The south holds the Fire Chariot prison. Then the west is the Diamond prison. And up north, you find the Cold Abyss prison. Each one delivers a different kind of torment in a cycle.
And it's important that Hudi is allowed to see this, right? He's not just stumbling around.
Oh, absolutely central to the plot. The King of Hell specifically wants Hudi to witness all this. You see, Hudi had been really wrestling with this idea of fairness. Why did the good guy, Yufei, suffer so much while this traitor, Qin Hui, seemed to get away with it all on Earth? So this tour is basically the King of Hell providing divine clarification. Like, look, justice does happen even if you don't see it immediately. Hudi is meant to report back, you know?
A messenger proving cosmic balance. Okay. So if Hudi's there to see justice served, the tour goes straight to the biggest target, okay. Qin Hui. He's already there, captive. In the description, naked, nailed to an iron bed, wearing an iron yoke. That's quite the fall from grace.
It's the ultimate humiliation, isn't it? The man who held immense power, now completely stripped bare, literally. And the text makes it clear he won't be alone for long. His cronies are on their way. The clerk points out that key figures in Yufei's death are due to arrive. Even figures from earlier history, like Kai Jing. They're all being gathered for this eternal routine of punishment.
And routine seems like the operative word. It's not one punishment and done. It's a cycle, a three-day cycle, you said, of being destroyed and then put back together. That just maximizes the agony, surely.
Precisely. It's designed for unending suffering, both physical and psychological. Let's walk through it. First, they're dragged off to the Wind and Thunder prison in the east. There, they're bound to a copper pillar. Then these wind knives appear and slice them up until their bodies are like sieves. Shredded. And if that wasn't enough, then dark thunder strikes them, obliterating them into basically dust and blood.
Wait, literally dust, like total annihilation. How do you come back from that?
Well, that's the terrifying part. Total annihilation, yes, but only for a moment. Instantly, an evil wind whips through, gathers all the particles, and reconstitutes them, perfectly restored to human form. That's the point, you see. It's not about dying. It's about experiencing dying over and over and then being made whole again just to face the next horror. No escape.
Wow. Okay. And they don't even get a breather, right? Straight to the next sector. The Diamond Prison.
Exactly. No rest. Rush straight to the west. The Diamond Prison. Here, demons with ox heads conjure this black wind filled with flying lances or phage. These things just swarm and pierce their bodies, causing, you know, excruciating pain and massive bleeding. And the moment that wind stops, they're immediately moved on to stage three.
Which involves fire.
Yeah.
That feels like a more traditional hellish element.
It is. They're taken south to the Fire Chariot Prism. A Yaksha demon forces them onto this chariot that's already ablaze. Then the demon uses a giant fan to whip the flames into an inferno. The chariot spins, and they're incinerated, turned instantly to ashes and soot, Weijin. But again, just like before, a sprinkle of water and poof, back to human form, fully restored. The literary message seems clear. Their evil nature can't be destroyed, only punished endlessly.
Unbelievable. Okay, so wind, piercing metal, fire. What's the final stage in this three-day circuit?
The cold. They're driven north to the Cold Abyss Prison. Here, it's long spears impaling them. Then they're plunged into freezing water. While submerged, they're hacked to pieces. Then finally, dragged out with iron hooks, instantly restored again, and sent back to where they started.
Back to the old place, nailed to that steel column. So after being sliced, blasted, pierced, burned, frozen, hacked, what happens between these cycles? Is there any rest?
Not rest, just a different kind of torment. Back at the starting point, nailed up, they're doused in boiling oil, and their basic needs become torture. If they feel hunger, they're force-fed iron pills. If they feel thirst, they're made to drink molten copper. It's Lent.
Yeah, every bodily sensation is turned against them.
That's eternal torment defined, really. But it gets worse, doesn't it? The punishment actually spills out of hell and into the real world. This part is particularly striking. Yes, this is where the narrative really twists the knife, so to speak. It connects the supernatural punishment back to the mortal realm they betrayed. The clerk explains that after 3 years of enduring this nonstop cycle in hell, these traitors undergo a transformation. They become livestock, cattle, sheep, pigs, dogs, reborn into the mortal world. And the specific purpose of this rebirth, to be killed and eaten by humans. This whole cycle, hellish torment, transformation, rebirth as an animal, slaughter, consumption, restoration back in hell to start again, is said to repeat for 50 plus generations. The text explicitly says there is no end. It's absolute condemnation.
And Qin Hu's wife, Wang Shi, who often gets blamed in popular history too.
Yeah.
She doesn't escape this.
Not at all. The text is clear. She suffers the exact same torments as her husband. And after her 3 years, she's specifically transformed into a mother sow, forced to breed, give birth, and then inevitably face slaughter herself. The narrative really aims for complete annihilation of their legacy, spiritually and physically, across generations.
It's hard to fathom anything worse than what Qin Hui endures. But the system has other targets, right? It expands beyond just his immediate circle. There's the prison of treachery and retribution.
That's right, the Jianhui Ziyu. This one casts a wider net. It's for corrupt prime ministers in general, treacherous military leaders, anyone in high office who deceived their ruler or put themselves before the nation, and their punishment. They get the same brutal three-day cycle as Qin Hui. Wind, thunder, lances, fire, ice, the whole thing. The message is pretty clear. High-level betrayal leads to this specific brand of eternal suffering and humiliation as livestock.
But then there's this other category, the disloyal internal officials, the Buzhong Nei Chen Ziyu. This seems aimed squarely at historical eunuchs, and
yeah.
The punishment is, well, it's uniquely bizarre and graphic.
It really is one of the most visually arresting and frankly disturbing scenes in the description. Hu Di sees hundreds of female cows tied to iron posts, and they're being roasted alive over fires. Naturally, Hu Di is confused. Why torture cows? But the clerk just tells him to watch closely. As the heat intensifies, the cows start writhing, their skin bursts open, and they transform, right there, into human figures, but specifically beardless ones.
Wow. Okay, that transformation is deeply unsettling. What's the significance there, and what happens next?
Well, these newly transformed beardless figures are immediately scooped up and thrown into huge iron pots filled with boiling liquid. They're boiled down until only white bones are left. Then, of course, they're restored, and the whole roasting, transforming, boiling cycle starts again. The text connects this directly to figures like the 10 regular attendants from the Han Dynasty or Tung Wan from the Song, eunuchs who gained power within the palace, amassed wealth, and harmed loyal officials.
So the transformation itself is symbolic. From female animals into beardless men, it's linking their perceived corruption to their status within the Forbidden City, a kind of literal depiction of perceived moral distortion.
That seems to be exactly the intended reading. The punishment mirrors the perceived nature of their crime. Betrayal from within, exploiting a position of unique access, seen by the narrative as somehow unnatural, its very targeted symbolism. And then, almost as an aside, the text mentions one more general prison area along the east wall. This seems to be a catch-all for thousands more souls. Run-of-the-mill corrupt officials, unfilial children, thieves, lechers. They get more generalized torments like being cooked, flayed, having hearts ripped out, being ground into paste. Standard stuff, relatively speaking.
Standard stuff. Right. So after seeing all of this, this incredibly elaborate system of divine retribution, how does Hu Dia react? This was the whole point of his tour, after all.
He's completely overwhelmed, but in a positive way, strangely. The text says he's overjoyed. He feels his sense of outrage, his feeling that the world was unjust, has been totally vindicated. He actually declares, "Heaven and earth are impartial. Ghosts and spirits are clearly discerning. The system works, even if it's invisible to mortals."
And this is where the King of Hell gives him a job to do, right? To make this judgment official.
Exactly. It's not enough just to witness it. The king commands Hu Di to write it all down as a formal verdict, a panwin. This document is meant to serve as the official permanent condemnation, something that theoretically could be known back in the mortal world.
And reading parts of that verdict, it's absolutely brutal. It's not just listing crimes, it's a complete demolition of Qin Hui's character for all time. What are some of the key accusations?
Oh, it pulls no punches. It starts by saying he fundamentally lacked the skill for governing, calling him metaphorically a bucket of small capacity, basically incompetent. Then it attacks his character, saying he had the looks of a deer but the heart of a tiger, flattering the emperor while being secretly villainous, calls him a wolf in sheep's clothing. It accuses him of having a jackal and leopard heart and a serpent and scorpion nature. Just pure animalistic evil. And crucially, it lists his crimes. Abusing power, suppressing good people, and this is key, colluding with the enemy state, the Jin, as if they were his own relatives.
And the ultimate crime, the one that truly seals his fate in this narrative, is stated explicitly.
Absolutely. The verdict leaves no doubt. His greatest unforgivable sin was engineering the murder of the loyal, heroic general Yu Fei. King Yama himself.
Right, he convenes this major event, the trials, saying Kaluyan. It's not just any old judgment. It's a high-profile tribunal to set the record straight.
Okay, so let's unpack this trial. Who exactly is called in? Who needs to be there for Yama to make his point?
Well, it's quite the guest list. You have King Yama presiding, of course. Then there's Hu Di the Doubter. General Yu Fei is there. His son Yu Yun. General Zhang Xian. And even the Jin Prince, Wu Zu. All brought together.
Wow, that's a tense room. And Yama has a very clear objective here, doesn't he? It's more than just punishing someone.
Absolutely. He states it up front. The whole point is to demonstrate for Hu Di and everyone else that heaven, earth, ghosts, gods, they're all fundamentally impartial and selfless. Bingong Wuxi.
So the unfairness people perceive.
Yama argues it's just about timing. Retribution might be swift or slow, light or heavy, the bowing King Zong Yun Jinzibi, but it will happen. Justice isn't absent. It just runs on a different schedule, you know?
It's interesting he doesn't deny the injustice Yu Fei faced on Earth. He just reframes it within a larger cosmic context.
Exactly. And the first big move to prove this impartiality is revealing the true status of the heroes.
Ah, right. Yu Yan and Zhang Xian.
Yes. Yama reveals they are actually high-ranking star officials Lei Fu Xing Guan. They descended to Earth for a specific purpose, and their deaths were, in a way, part of that mission.
So they're about to get promoted back to heaven.
Pretty much. Yama says they'll soon receive an imperial decree to return to their celestial posts. Their sacrifice wasn't in vain. It fulfilled a cosmic role.
Okay, but I have to ask, does that kind of take away from their heroism? If it was all just a planned mission and they're just going back to their old jobs, doesn't that make the tragedy feel a bit orchestrated?
That's a fair point from a modern perspective, maybe. Yeah. But I think for the original audience, it achieves the opposite. It confirms their ultimate importance.
How so?
It means their deaths weren't just the result of petty court politics. They weren't just victims. They were celestial beings involved in a grander struggle. Their status is validated by heaven itself. It elevates rather than diminishes
their sacrifice, you know?
Okay. Certified by the stars, as you put it. I see that. So celestial status confirmed. But for the system to seem truly just, there needs to be punishment too, right? Tangible payback.
Oh, absolutely. And that brings us straight to Kinui. He's brought forward, already shackled and chained, clearly suffering in the afterlife.
But Yama wants to make a public example of him.
Exactly. Right there, in front of Hu Di, the man who doubted, Yama orders Tinhui to be beaten severely with 20 copper rods.
And the text doesn't hold back on the description, does it?
Not at all. It's meant to be satisfying for the reader. Jinhui is left covered in blood, Xiem Su Li Li Lin utterly broken, before being dragged back to deeper suffering in hell. It's brutal, immediate justice.
Earthly justice failed, but cosmic justice delivers, viscerally.
That's the message.
Okay, so heroes vindicated, traitor punished. What about Hu Di, the guy who started all this with his doubts? He saw everything.
His outcome is actually surprisingly positive. Yama pardons him.
Pardons him for challenging heaven.
Yeah, because the trial revealed his motive. He wasn't being malicious. His doubts came from a place of staunch righteousness and integrity. He was genuinely troubled by perceived injustice.
He was looking for truth, not just complaining.
Precisely. And he gets a reward for it, too. His lifespan is extended by a cycle. Yiji. That's 12 years.
12 extra years. Not bad. But getting him back to his body is urgent.
Extremely urgent. His body has been technically dead for a while. And Yama needs to get his soul back before it starts to decay. Why La Quorca?
So how do they do that?
Yama orders a spirit attendant to lend Hu Di, the fast-footed steed, the Jijiaoju. Think of it as a supernatural express service.
Not exactly a comfortable ride, I imagine.
Definitely not. The text says the horse runs like flying clouds and lightning, just impossibly fast. Hu Di is terrified, closes his eyes, just hangs on for dear life.
And then he makes the mistake of opening them.
He does, and this is where it gets really terrifying, a real near-death experience moment. He sees he's not on solid ground, but on this incredibly narrow path. It's between two 10,000-foot deep chasms. One Zhang Shen Yan Yan, and just endless drops on either side. Imagine that vertigo combined with the speed.
I can't even.
It's too much. He panics, falls off the horse, and wakes up.
Wakes up back in his own body.
Yes. And the validation is immediate and overwhelming. He finds out he's been dead for 3 days. His family was literally in the middle of preparing his funeral.
Wow. Talk about timing.
Right. And when he tells them his story, the trial, Yu Fei, Jin Hui, they're amazed.
Yeah.
But then comes the clincher.
What's that?
His family confirms that Jin Hui, the traitor, had actually died yesterday.
So Hu Di literally saw him arrive in the underworld and get punished almost immediately after his death.
Exactly. It proves everything Hu Di experienced was real. His doubts are completely erased.
And this changes him fundamentally.
Completely. He gives up all ambition for fame or wealth. Spends the rest of his life doing good deeds, charity zai, sangbushi, guangxing shanxi, lives peacefully past 90. He becomes living proof that the cosmic system works.
Okay, so that seems like a neat resolution. Justice served, doubter convinced, happy ending for Hu Di. But that's not the end of the story, is it? Wu Zu was also at that trial.
He was, and that's the pivot. While Hu Di finds peace, Wu Zu finds something else. Back in the mortal world, there's a political shift in the Jin court.
Right, the succession.
Yeah, Wan Yinaguda dies, then Wu Qimai, and eventually Wan Yindong takes the throne. Wu Zu attends the ceremony, comes back feeling moody, maybe unsettled by the underworld experience. And he dreams about the trial again.
And this dream becomes the trigger for more war. How?
It hinges on a critical misinterpretation, a single phrase. This is where you see how ambition can twist even a divine message.
What did Yama actually say to Wu Zu during the trial?
Yama had told him he would soon return to his position, Giwei, which likely meant returning to his princely station or maybe his eventual fate. Something administrative, almost.
Okay, return to position. But what did Wu Zu think he heard in the dream?
He hears something similar, but crucially different. He believes Yama said he would soon ascend to the throne, Zheng Wei.
Wait, throne? That's a massive leap. From return to position to ascend to the throne.
Exactly. It's a huge difference. But Wu Zu, described as maybe a bit coarse and rash, latches on to the meaning he wants to hear.
So is the source implying this massive historical consequence, this huge invasion, boils down to Wu Zu needing a hearing aid? Or maybe just wishful thinking amplified in a dream. It seems almost anticlimactic after Yama's big show of perfect justice.
Well, that's a fascinating part, isn't it? The justice was perfect for Hu Dei, who was seeking truth. But Wu Zu was driven by ambition. His own desires colored his interpretation.
So he filters the message through his own lens.
Completely. He hears ascend to the throne and immediately thinks, ha, a divine decree. He convinces himself he's on a mission from heaven, Fingzi UZGJ, destined to be emperor.
And his logic follows from there.
Yes. Yu Fei, the only one who really stopped the djinn before, is dead. Xin Hui, the obstacle remover, is also gone. So in Wuzhu's mind, the path is clear. Heaven wants him to conquer the Song.
Wow. So the divine justice part, Qin Hui's punishment, gets completely overshadowed by Wuzhu's ambition, twisting a different part of the message.
Pretty much. The removal of Yu Fei, combined with this misinterpreted mandate, gives him all the justification he needs.
And he acts on this immediately.
Oh, yeah. No hesitation. He calls in his strategist, Hami Qi, and advisor, Hu Ermi. Starts planning the invasion right away.
This isn't just a minor raid, then.
Not at all. He gathers a massive coalition. The text lists all the key commanders. Wan Yangan, Nian Dali, Zhang Baoma, Mao Lian, Mi Tejin. It's the full might of the Jin military machine.
How big are we talking?
The source says 50,000 troops. 500,000. 51. An enormous force, moving vastly and powerfully towards the Song heartland.
500,000, based on a misheard dream. That's terrifying.
It is. Their stated goal is to break the capital Po Jingcheng and smash the central plains.
Yeah.
The author really ramps up the description here.
How do they describe the army?
With really evocative imagery. Iron cavalry like clouds, bows bent like the shadow of the moon, drums pounding like the sound of waves. It's presented as this overwhelming, almost natural disaster heading for the Song.
And how's the Song court reacting?
Panic. Reports are flooding in like snowflakes. They're totally caught off guard by the scale and speed of this invasion, fueled by Wuzhu's delusion.
So the source just leaves us there, hanging, with this massive army bearing down, all because of Wuzhu's mistake.
That's exactly where it leaves off.
Yeah.
The fate of the Southern Song rests on Emperor Gaozong's next move.